Yo, what is up, my friends? Welcome to Dostcast. My name is Vinamra Kasana. We release new episodes of this podcast every Tuesday and Friday at 12 p.m. Indian Standard Time. 1 million subs is our goal. Let's hit it soon. Today's guest is Christian Angermayer from my friends in India. You don't know who he is. He is a rich man interested in psychedelics, happiness, longevity. Did I say billionaire? I'm going to say it again. Why I'm interested in this conversation is because through his private investment firm, Aperon Investment Group, he has more than $2.5 billion of assets under management. I'm kidding. I'm not interested in his billions. What I am interested in is Christian is a fascinating individual who has very clear ideas about how you can achieve happiness and adequate mental health through psychedelic-assisted therapies, right? This particular conversation is going to blow your mind because we discuss how several people in the world have been benefited from using psilocybin and other forms of psychedelics to assist depression, PTSD, anxiety, of course, in clinical settings. That is something that his company does. Fascinating individual because he is optimizing for, like I already mentioned, psychedelics, happiness, and longevity, which is something that's going to strike as surprising or even fascinating to some of us in the world who feel like happiness is a luxury. So we get into a lot of that. We also talk about how religions in the past often used psychedelics as initiation rituals, as ways to get deeper in the community, all of those things. This is a fascinating conversation, one that I had the pleasure to record in London when I was visiting. So obviously enjoy the conversation. And of course, don't forget to subscribe. The episode with Christian Angermayer begins in 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, thank you so much, bro, for being here. And obviously, if it was not for Matt Gray's post on Instagram, I would not know about you. He just, like, here's seven founders who are changing the world. And I just saw your stuff. And ever since, it's just been just diving deep into your life, all the fascinating things you've done. And I wanted to start with something very cool, which is on your website. It's like you want to invest in happiness, right? Now, there are several people in the world who would say that happiness is a wasteful idea. It's something that teenagers believe in. It's a fanciful notion of life. You should instead invest in or try to build a life around purpose, meaning, discipline, all of those things, as opposed to happiness, which is, I don't know, like many would equate it with pleasure. But it seems like most of what you do, the businesses that you invest in, the life that you lead, the interests that you have, all center on happiness.
Well, so first of all, thanks for having me. Great. I always love doing podcasts because you can explore things deeper than, I don't know, in a short interview, in a written one. Happiness. First of all, I think it's like definition is important. It's not sort of the giggly one, like the, because you use the word pleasure. It's more like really like sort of these deep rooted feeling that your life and everything in it is all right, even if you have bad days, whatever. So more like this sort of philosophical, deeper meaning of happiness. And then I would say that's the main goal of life, like, because everything leads to it. Like my there is a, and by the way, it's coming from an Indian fellow, like, you know, Deepak Chopra.
Of course.
So whom I adore, like, we're actually working together now, like, but I'm his biggest fan since I'm a teenager. And in one of his books, he had sort of these very simple sort of explanation of why happiness is so important. If you ask people, what do you want in life? So in the first sort of set of answers, you might get different ones. Some people might say, oh, I want a family. I want money. I want success. I want purpose, whatever. Like, so then you, if you go, but why do you want that? Why do you want a family? Why do you want money? Whatever. So then maybe comes another level of answers. Oh, I want to have purpose and I want to da da da. But if you always keep on asking why do you want purpose, like, it's like at the very end every single human being will answer that question, because I want to be happy. Yeah, so happiness is sort of the core thing we seem to long for. And I know there are some religions who say, oh, actually the permanent pursuit of happiness is making us actually sad, or like it's not a good thing. I don't believe that. I think it's more like the how you do it. It's not that obsession, whatever. Again, and it's sort of the definition of happiness. But I believe we should be happy, and we should dare to say it, because I think a big part of unhappiness, which I realized, especially when talking to patients in our clinical studies or to friends who did it recreationally, yeah, who did psychedelics, that one of the big and easy and maybe complicated things, how psychedelic works, they show people what they really want in life, yeah, and they give them the courage to sort of follow that path, and that seems to make people truly happy, yeah. So long story short, I think it's what we actually deserve to be as humans, and what is sort of one of the core goals of life is to be happy.
The other problem that then arises from that is, okay, great. We've established that psychedelics at some level, when you do it clinically and safely, reveal to you that this is what makes you happy. This is what sets your soul on fire, right? But then how do you sustain that? Because that's a revelation that happens on the psychedelic, and then you descend back to your real life and you still have to sort of move the pieces around. And then what? Do you wait for the next trip? Do you wait for the next, I guess, some other revelation to sustain that? Because you still have to go through your life, right?
Well, so first of all, because we're already at the topic of psychedelics, which is obviously always my favorite topic. So the disclaimer for everybody who's watching, yeah. And also, I really mean it. So two of my companies, Atai and Compass, do develop psychedelics as a medical solution for various mental health issues, mm-hmm. Like depression, anxiety, addiction. I personally, happy to talk about that, have actually an even bigger view, and happiness is already one, because not being happy is not a clinical disease, unless you're so unhappy that we call it depression. So I have a broader view on psychedelics, but still, in any case, I believe psychedelics are medical therapies. We shouldn't call them drugs. So they're medical therapies. By the way, they have been that over the last 10,000 years, always highly regulated. So these are not party drugs. People should not do that when they watch this podcast on their own. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm working hard, and I hope that the first sort of psychedelics, especially the active ingredient in so-called magic mushrooms, psilocybin, will be available medically in 2 years. Yeah, and that means that hopefully in the future you can go to a therapist and do it psychedelics with them. So it's not meant for party consumption. It's also not meant to be done alone, because it is a very strong, deep medication, yeah, which needs to be taken in the right setting with a guy together. Yeah. And then there are some countries already, like most of South America, for example, where psychedelics are not classified. So they're practically not illegal, like they are, unfortunately, in the Western world. So there are places in the world where people can do psychedelics legally already today. But again, don't do it just like at a party. Do it in the proper setting, like our ancestors used to do it. But then they have an enormous potential to sort of, in any sense, improve your life. That's just an important backdrop if we're now very easily talking about these sort of very positively meant strong medications. Yeah, so to your questions, that's one of the fascinating properties of psychedelics, is that you have a very deep revelation, and very simplified said, you realize, or one of the properties, I think, or one of the, how do you say in English, threats, red, we call it in a red string in Germany, what is sort of evident in most of the trips people have when we talk to them after, is that you realize what you really want. And it sounds so simple, but it's one of, I think, the biggest problems of our lives.
People do 7 questions why, or they consult 5-10 family friends to ask them what they want.
But a problem is in real life, when you're not on a trip, that your ego is so strong that even, yes, we have some tricks and some party tricks, 7 questions, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work, because you have this wall, which is your ego. And since you're born, two things happen. Other people tell you what they want you to be, and you respond because you want to be liked, or you have for positive reasons, because you want to fit in, or for negative reasons, because you're afraid of rejection. You sort of form that strong belief what you should be, but it's not that this is what you really want. It's like a reaction on outside demand on yourself. Yeah, and that wall is practically impossible to break through in a non-psychedelic state. At least it's very, very hard. By the way, because you're from India, there are other techniques which people can use. So psychedelics are not sort of the one and only thing. Like, really professional meditation is another way to break your ego. However, how many people have truly time to meditate 2-3 hours a day for their whole life and become an expert in it, whatever, because it's not just like the 10 minutes, whatever mindfulness exercise people might tell you. So I think in the world we live in, which I accept, it's very busy, whatever, like psychedelics are sort of not an easy way, but like it's like a way people can fit in their life. But again, there would be other, like I have friends who do these 10 days or 14 days of
meditations.
The completely silenced ones, for 10, 14 days. Yeah. So again, not everybody can do that time-wise, whatever, but that leads to the same outcome. You break your ego. But long story short, and then you see who you truly are. And then a lot of people realize, by the way, very simple things. Yeah. This is what people sometimes say to me if I say, oh, what did you realize in psychedelics, or people you know? And then I tell them, and then, oh, that's simple. Like, I could have told you that. But the now comes to your point or to your question, the realization happens on such a deep level of also acceptance, that you're like, okay, now I know who I am, and you don't forget it. Like, different than, for example, when people are on alcohol, they can't remember things. You can remember every single minute of a psychedelic trip in a very good way. You can even recall it. And they also show you the way how to integrate that into your daily life. But, and this is why the guide is so important, as you said, the integration is super important. So the trip is just a revelation, and then you have to come out of your trip and have to sort of say, okay, now I'm start changing my life. And the trip hopefully gave you the both the knowledge and the courage to do so, but it's still work to do so. And normally this is why, is one of the many reasons why therapy is so important, to do it with psychedelics or psychedelics with therapy, because the therapist can then help you to integrate whatever you learn, what is important for you, into your daily life.
I think the few times that I've experimented with psychedelics, I've noticed that I discovered that the Imperial College of London was the first to do psilocybin trials. And then I discovered this gentleman called Mendel Kaelin. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he makes these music for like psychedelic therapies. And I was, you know, at a place, and I decided that maybe I can just play the playlist and ingest the psychedelic and do it myself. The issue was, and I had done it in the past, I did not have anyone to integrate it. So while it was the most revelatory, beautiful experience of my life up till date on psychedelics, I don't think I can have a thread that ties me back to it necessarily. Like, it just looks like, in my conscience, it looks like an event that happened, but the experiential wisdom from it seems to have been lost for some reason. So how does this integration process work? Because you've got the companies where like people actually undergo these trials for depression and other problems, right? And so does the therapist or the clinician, do they ask you a few questions? Do they help you like write stuff down? Like, how does the integration work out?
So first, interestingly, psychedelics actually do have an inbuilt integration mechanism, which is simplified called neuroplasticity. So practically the weeks and partly months after, we see that in a very simplified way. When I say your brain is growing, it's mainly forming new connections and new pathways in your brain. Again, sort of the word for it is neuroplasticity. And actually, Michael Pollan, who wrote an amazing book, so whoever
How to
wants
Change Your Mind.
So whoever wants to go deeper after that podcast, How to Change Your Mind is the book to read. And he describes it like, in a normal person's life, the older you get, by the way, this is normally psychedelics become more amazing the older you are, because you see the difference when you suddenly have sort of kind of a young, fresh view on the world again. So it's like ski slopes, and like you're always using the same ones, and they become so hard and so sort of impregnated in your brain. And then he's like, psychedelics is like it's freshly snowed, and your plane is a fresh sort of virgin plate, so to say. And you can decide, oh, I always went left with my thought, now I'm deciding to go right. So there is this inbuilt, and this is extremely helpful practically for integration, because you have the experience, and then sort of psychedelics enable your brain to be more open for change based on the experience. Yeah. So some people can do it without somebody permanently helping them, but like obviously a therapist, it's already helpful when I tell you that, like that there is practically this inbuilt mechanism. So, and it works best the first weeks after a trip. So practically one simple thing is like to make you aware of that fact, which a lot of people don't know, and say, look, just be especially mindful now to the next weeks after a trip to do whatever you really want to do now newly in your life. And if it's simple stuff, go to the gym, like don't eat sugar, whatever. By the way, this is why it helps. It helps both. It helps getting off habits. So for example, when people want to eat healthier, uh-huh. want to eat less sugar, want to come off a bad substance like alcohol, it's like it's extremely, the first weeks after a psychedelic trip are extremely habit forming. Yeah, so you have to focus yourself on the good habits you want to create and sort of get rid of the bad habits, yeah, you want to get rid of. So it's more like then a conscious awareness of, okay, that's the time I'm going into now where I can truly change my life. Yeah, and hopefully you have done that already before. So practically in the future, a psychedelic session or a therapy will consist of pre-work, because I want to prepare you for what's happening in a trip and then also what's after. So for example, if I were a therapist, I would always make the patient aware that, hey, time the trip in a way that the weeks after you really have time, and not just like if you're a businessman, whatever, start traveling again, like that you have time to focus on whatever you want to achieve. So I personally, for example, try to do my psychedelic trips for that reason in a holiday. Uh-huh. Yeah, where I'm like sort of already calmed down, where I have time to think about stuff, what I want to take out of the trip, so you can prepare yourself, and where I have time after sort of to integrate that. So it's more like it's very practical, but a guide often is just making you aware of the obvious. So there is no magic in what a guide can do, but like just having somebody who makes you aware, who maybe checks in with you every 2 days and says, look, that's what you wrote down, let's journal, let's after a trip, let's like write down how you want to change your life. And then he's just a little bit accountancy is very good. Like people calling you like, hey, are you sticking to your plan and whatever? Yeah. But the important information is that there is this inbuilt mechanism called neuroplasticity, which is probably fascinating if you think about it, like sort of somebody, God or whatever, gave these plants the not just the psychedelic ability for the trip, but this inbuilt sort of ability for long-term change.
That's true. I can recall the, like I was telling you before we started recording, that I was in LA and I did this 5-MeO DMT experience, and I was obviously shot into space, like literally. And I felt that my asshole was clenched, my hands were clenched, my kneecaps were clenched, my toes were clenched. And I was afraid that something bad was going to happen, that I was going to die, right? But something stronger inside me said that it's okay, let go. And as soon as I did, a smile came on my face. And, you know, after trips, people often try to, when people ask them, how did you change? You usually have tangible statements so that it's easier to make people understand. But I remember I became okay with myself. I became okay with, I guess, like I was living in America and trying to adapt to American ways. I suddenly became more okay with where I was from. And a bunch of cool things happened. Like my self-expression opened up in a way where I didn't feel as restricted. It was just one of those times. Other times, it's just been nothing at all, right? And then I discovered what people call microdosing, right? Which is something pretty popular in LA, in Silicon Valley. Like tons of people do that for focus and productivity. And I have a few friends who said, maybe we can try that out. So we basically just started taking 1/16 doses of the psilocybin. But it was very mixed results. One, because there was no protocol in place. Second, you never know when it's a microdose and when it's like slightly above. So you're like, oh shit, I'm at the threshold. So I'm just going to get a blanket and sleep today, because I don't think I can use the enhanced creativity that the microdose is supposed to give me. I think it's a little bit above that. So,
And we don't even know, by the way. Microdosing is a novel thing. Like sort of, if you talk about deep psychedelic trips, building on, say, 10,000 years of human experience with psychedelics, microdosing is a new idea. It's a very Silicon Valley idea. It's always a little bit like, oh, can I have it easy, the easy way? Like, yeah. Do I really need the full trip? Like, and all the work, which is, can I just take a tiny bit? So the assumption is that if you do microdosing, so practically staying under the threshold, which would make you what we colloquially call trip, yeah, you still get the neuroplasticity. So that's what they're seeking. Because, and yes, neuroplasticity in itself is very positive, but I personally believe that sort of the true effect comes from that deep learning mm-hmm. and understanding, again, about yourself, about the world, about your place in it, which you have on a psychedelic trip, and then sort of the integration ability the neuroplasticity gives you. And yes, neuroplasticity is associated also with openness, with creativity whatsoever. So the point is, people always think, oh, Christian is like so like daring and whatever. Actually, everything I do, I'm a super hypochondriac still, is based on a hypochondriac, like when you're okay. afraid of doing the wrong thing for your body right. or whatever. Like, I'm always afraid of, yeah. So I'm actually very conservative. People don't think that, oh, he's talking about psychedelics, he must be like very daring. No, I'm very conservative because I want to do things where I know for a fact what they do to me. Uh-huh. And we know for a fact because, A, humans use psychedelics for a long time. We have all the studies in the 50s and 60s, and now we have our studies. Like, we did the biggest study ever, yeah, with psilocybin. Yeah, hundreds of participants.
And Atai or the other company?
Compass. Psilocybin is done at Compass, and Atai has a stake in Compass. Yeah, so Compass did the biggest study ever with psilocybin. So we know for a fact it does work. We know for a fact there is a very low risk profile and all of that.
And what did you do the study on? Like, people with depression?
Treatment-resistant depression, yeah.
Okay.
So, but what I want to say, nobody did that so far for microdosing. It's a very novel idea. There are no studies from the 50s and 60s because they all went for the full trip. There are no studies now. I think there are 2-3 now. So, but we don't know 2 things. We don't know if it really works or if it's placebo. Placebo in your mind, by the way, is very strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and sort of all the studies I saw about the positive effects of microdosing are inconclusive. They are like, yeah, some are maybe, but it's not big. Like, actually, some studies believe it's a lot of placebo. But second, we don't know if it's sort of in any way risky if you do take psychedelics every whatever the protocol is. And there is no real protocol because we don't know. Yeah, but some people do it every 3 days, whatever. But for a long time, we don't know. Like, yeah. Do I think that this is a big problem? No, but like, we don't know. Yeah. So while I can tell you everything scientifically about the one full trip, like how our ancestors did this, and I think people should not try to take the too easy way. Like, you can say psychedelics, a psychedelic trip is already the easy way because mm-hmm. you also could do 3 hours of meditation for 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
So doing a full psychedelic trip with a guide is already shortening the time for revelation.
Sure.
Don't try to shorten it more. Like, again, because if you're getting too easy, there's this old thing in any religion that you have to put effort into something.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
it's a ritual. It's a sacred ritual.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the people I spoke with usually talked about anecdotal evidence, what happened with them, as opposed to using any study to say that, you know, this actually works. Yeah. So I was suspicious of it as well. And I had mixed results, obviously. I did want to discuss with you, because your companies conduct all of these studies, what have been the results of, say, psilocybin on treatment-resistant depression? Has depression gone away? Has alcoholism gone away? Because you have access to all of this data, what have you seen from the people who've signed up for these trials? Is it largely positive, in the positive direction?
Yes. Meaning, like, Compass was like, it's 2 years ago, so I should remember, obviously, the exact number, but there was a high percentage, high double digit, I think it was more than 50%. Please, people, look it up. Like, but it was more than 50% people in a full remission from treatment-resistant depression, which is unheard of. Yeah, uh-huh. Which with practically very low side effects. So a huge positive impact on potentially even, use the word, curing treatment-resistant depression, or at least making it significantly sort of better. Yeah, sort of improve the state of the people. And then in other studies, as you said, like the psilocybin especially, but all psychedelics have a very broad usage. Like, I would always say they're good for anything in your brain. Like, but the 4 things we're focusing on in Atai and Compass are depression, and the worst form, treatment-resistant depression, then anxiety, addiction of bad substances, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. So these, that's sort of the, but by, and so in how drug development work, you always prove it on one disease first so that you know it works, that you get your approval, and then you can do more follow-on studies sort of to broaden the use case for it.
Yeah. And as far as like signing up for these, where people can sort of benefit that, is it legally not possible for you guys to start dispensing these en masse yet in, maybe not in every country in the world, but at least in the UK, parts of Europe, or the US, like as far as the legal status of allowing you guys to just, you know, basically sell these medicines to the masses, what is that?
So technically, so it's like any, like what we're doing is, by the way, like in a good way, almost boring, in terms of we're doing it like we would do it for any other new medical drug. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's FDA and EMA, European Medical Agency trials. Yeah. And at the end, hopefully, we're going to see a drug approval, and then you roll it out, in our case, to, or you educate the therapists, because it's going to be a drug which is just be taken, as I said, with a therapist.
In a clinic.
In a day clinic, yeah. Yeah. So clinic, in terms of you don't need to stay overnight,
yeah.
But you're going to go to your therapist, do it with them, and then you can go home. Yeah. But you cannot do it alone at home. So it's not a prescription medicine where you go to the pharmacy and say, hey, can I have my psilocybin? You have to go to your doctor, do it with them, then go home. So that's a normal drug approval process. But that means at the moment, yeah, it's not available yet because we're not fully done. So Compass for psilocybin is in phase 3. Yeah. And then we have in Atai, we have various other psychedelics following, like DMT, which is the ingredient in ayahuasca, a new version of MDMA, ibogaine, which is a very strong psychedelic, which is mainly used for addiction. So how I see, by the way, the future is, if somebody might ask now, oh, why so many psychedelics, is that they all are very positive for you, yeah, but one works better for this and one works better for that. So for example, we know ibogaine, which is a plant, or the cover of a tree, what is it called, a bark, I think in English, like,
yeah, bark, yeah, yeah.
Indigenous people in the area of Gabon are using, is the strongest one for addiction. So all psychedelics have anti-addictive properties. So you can use, for example, there are great studies out there how you can use psilocybin already to treat alcoholism and stuff like that. But the stronger the addiction gets, and the strongest addiction we know is opioids, including heroin. And we know, for example, in the US, unfortunately, there is this huge crisis of opioid addiction, fentanyl. So you need ibogaine. But ibogaine shows in earlier studies, because it's not as far developed as psilocybin is, but extremely strong success potential to get people off opioids or off heroin within a single trip, which is a very long one, 24 hours about. Yeah, so you need to stay in the hospital, actually.
The ibogaine trip is 24 long?
Yeah, or longer.
24 hours long?
Yeah.
Wow.
But people come off and are literally not craving for whatever they're addicted to, but including heroin. So long story short, psilocybin is sort of the furthest advanced in phase 3, which should hopefully lead to an approval in 2025. And then all the other psychedelics are following the years after. So we are with DMT, we're going soon into phase 2. Ibogaine is going soon into phase 2. So we're like 3-4 years behind psilocybin with the other psychedelics.
Amazing. From here, I want to take two different segues. One, there's this book by Aldous Huxley called... Sorry. I'm also forgetting. It's on the tip of my tongue. Island. It's called Island. It's about a fictional island of Pala. And it's where Eastern medicine has met Western science. And so it's an island like close to Sri Lanka. Like it's a fictional island where... basically, one of the things is for the kids to initiate into adulthood. There's a cave where there's a huge statue of Shiva, and there, the kids are supposed to do two things. One, they have to be on the same rope and rock climb to understand life and death. Second, they have to take mushrooms, and that's an initiation ritual that they do in this book, and it's the opposite of the other dystopic book that Aldous Huxley wrote, which is the name of which I've forgotten now, as a counter to what the utopia could look like. But the initiation was through psychedelics, right? And off camera, we were talking about the various cultures and religions which have had psychedelics at the center of initiation rituals, of celebration, of, you know, for someone ascending to even shamanhood, you know, they would use psychedelics to initiate them in several things. And your websites also mentioned several Greek gods who have been, there's been links with them and psychedelics. So obviously one is the scientific perspective. The second is talking about your experiences, but the religious angle always fascinates me, right? How did you further deepen your understanding of psychedelics and your passion for them? Was it because of reading these stories?
Okay, very broad question, because my favorite one. So I would say that's my personal sort of gut feeling, because you can't fully prove it. You can prove it for some, like, but I would say I believe most religions are founded on psychedelic experiences. I think we completely...
Or, sorry, just a sec. Psychedelic experiences or revelatory ecstatic experiences, which are not the same?
Well, which are most likely induced by psychedelics. Yeah. So I think, like, again, you see whatever in stories, people fasting for very long. Again, yeah, there are other ways to produce the same sort of experience. And there is this famous experience where a team around Timothy Leary in the 60s went to India and met yogis who were meditating their whole life and gave them, it's actually on camera, like gave them high doses of LSD.
Oh yeah, it was Ramdas.
He gave it
to Neem Karoli Baba.
And I think they didn't change, because they were like in that state, in and out, because they could fully control it. So it's not saying that, so practically, let's say, I think most religions are based on these kind of experiences, which can be induced by psychedelics or by intense other exercises, but they lead to the same experience. This is why I believe, actually, that's, and that's a beautiful thing, I hope, is like, if you go to the core of most religions, yeah, they are very much the same. Yeah, which is a shame that it's the opposite how we live it. Like, because they, in the core, most of them are like, look, just be a nice guy. Like, the core of Christianity is like, treat other people like you want to be treated. It's such a simple sentence, but it would change the world if we all sort of would live by that. But most other religion also come to that. Don't be a dick. Yeah, don't do bad stuff. Like, it's so simple and so complicated at the same time. Yeah. So, and then also, like, many things, once you have done psychedelics, and I'm very interested, I was actually also before psychedelics, in religion in general, like in how people, because I'm personally, I would say, I would call myself spiritually, just for the sake of not attaching it to a certain religion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But like, I think, because again, I think in the core, all religions are very, very the same. But like, if you then read ancient religious texts, like from any religion, then you suddenly realize, oh, I know what this guy is talking about. Like, oh, a chariot driving through the sky, burning and seeing, like, you're like, okay, you were high, but in a good way. It's not then people like, oh, is this like blasphemy or whatever? But I think, no, because I personally, by the way, I always have to distinguish. It's actually sad that you have to say it, because like, science became so anxious to talk about spirituality, and we shouldn't, yeah? But like, I just want to make clear, there are certain things on this podcast I can say sort of as a founder of a biotech company who does clinical trials.
So this is you facts, as Christian.
Yes. And then I have my personal beliefs, which maybe are never provable, but it's not important. But like, it's important for me. Like, but like, I believe, like, you look at those guys, like, you, or it makes actually, for me, those experiences, these prophets or founders of religions are talking about, much more valuable, because my personal belief is that psychedelics are a gateway to God. And then already the problem is, now when I say God, like, certain people or different people with different religious backgrounds have a different immediate, okay, what is he talking about? This God. So let's call it the divine. Yeah. But like, yeah. And by the way, I think the Hindu religion came, if you talk to people, like, I think they came very close to, or I think, I always, if I look from the outside, I think Hinduism is the most psychedelic one, actually. Yeah. I mean, there are many things where recurring themes which people on psychedelics talk about, which then I was like, okay, I think I know the story. And then you go back and like, there is this one thing like Brahman's dream.
Yes, you were talking about Vishnu's dream on your Twitter.
Vishnu's dream, like, that the universe is just like practically is created and ending in just like one breath in and out, like, and stuff like that. I think that's very like, I think these are very psychedelic ideas.
It's also very active imagination from the writers, which you would assume, where would that come from?
Yeah.
So that leads to...
It's not like something that you wake up with. Like, yeah. That's how it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, but it, for me, it makes these religions more valuable because I do believe psychedelics are the way to communicate with the divine. Yeah. And so, and then they, people come back and then they have the problem, which is, by the way, a problem now in this podcast, is like, it's very, very hard to put the experience you do have on a psychedelic trip
in words.
In words. So what did they all do? They had to form pictures, yeah, or they had to describe it in a very colorful way.
Yeah.
They tried, yeah, to put their experience, which was so outerworldly that it's practically not able to. And then you have some religions who say God is even not describable because he's so sort of beyond the...
Beyond form.
Beyond form and beyond what we can in our current incarnation sort of comprehend in words. Yeah, but you can while you're on the trip and you remember it. I think the great thing of a trip is it's, you can remember your trip, you just can't get
express
it across
it
fully. Yeah, but yeah. Again, so this is why they resorted into, okay, let me describe it in a picture, da, da, da. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's sort of my view is, and I hopefully also like the whole work we're doing on the clinical side with psychedelics will lead to sort of kind of renaissance of religion and spirituality, because what I definitely believe is, and that is actually, and I'm working on studies, not with a tie, like more I'm personally financing to prove it. I definitely believe that we need spirituality and religion in our life. Like, even if God did not exist, I think it's very healthy to believe in them. Yeah. Because our life is miserable without.
Yeah, there's a definite crisis of meaning happening in the world right now. And I do notice that, especially in India, where I'm from, I see a lot of people who grew up believing that maybe, you know, going to a temple or worshiping a god was not cool, right, are now suddenly coming back as they find that they've exhausted all the worldviews that they could and they need something that grounds them. And so everyone sort of comes back to God that way. I also think it's because, you know, one of the other things that you're interested in is longevity. The people in the blue zones, they always have faith at the core of their communities.
No, I think, so I have a very cheesy model, I always say before, but like, I think it's the right one. I think it's like, and again, these are things I'm not coming up randomly, like, it's more like, because we talk to so many patients, like, uh-huh, and sort of, yeah, read like what is their experience, why, so... And sort of one thing, or the model I developed is, or what I believe in, and again, I want to put more, I think that is something you can put research behind, is like that we have like our body has an immune system. We're very aware of that. Yeah. But I think there is a mental immune system. Yeah. One simple sort of observation which leads to that idea is there is a lot of research actually already happening in terms of resilience. So why are people who are experiencing the same kind of harsh events, why are some of them, for example, becoming depressive, or why are some of them becoming addicted to numbing drugs like alcohol, heroin, whatever, and why can some people work through the problem and sort of come out even stronger? Yeah, so it's a big question in psychology. And it's a very important question, especially in our times when sort of, because like one thing I side note, which I think is very dangerous, we have this sort of woke idea that people need safe spaces and da da da. And I think that's actually creating a terrible outcome because there are some problems in life you cannot run away from.
Yeah.
And nobody else will be able to help you. And nobody else will be able to create a safe space because human conditions, the human condition has some things like the death of your parents. It will happen somewhere, and if life goes, if you're not dying earlier, so, and it's gonna be a terrible moment for you if nobody can save you
and
from.
No amount of stoicism can save you, by the way.
Yeah,
no amount of stoicism can save you, by the way.
So if you, my belief is you need to train a little bit, like sort of if you never had an adversity, then I think the inevitable ones will hit you harder.
Yeah.
So this is why I think it's so dangerous that we're trying to tell young people, oh, you can always run away from everything and you can shield you from everything. We can't. Yeah. You're going to be sick somewhere. You're going to have a tough time in your job. You're going to lose your parents. Like things like that happen to everybody of us. But then the question is, why are some more resilient and why are some not? So one idea is that you can train yourself a bit, like sort of if you're too shielded. So, but like the other idea I have, and is a little bit interconnected, is that we have a mental immune system, which consists actually, in my point of view, of three components. The one is faith, coming back to that in a second. The second one is purpose. And the third one, most cheesy one, is love. So, and I also believe, before I go into the details, that it's about the amount sort of these three components, which means, for example, you can substitute a little bit one by the other. If you look at older people who might not have family anymore, so no love and no purpose because they're old and unemployed or whatever, or not working, they gravitate automatically more towards religion. And I think their brain is almost like trying to balance that out automatically. So, or if somebody is a true atheist, I think this person can still lead a happy life and be resilient if the person has enough purpose and enough love. So what I mean in detail and why, like the one thing, what is the amazing thing about faith? As I said, the human condition is there is harsh events in our life. And one of the harshest ones is either you dying somewhere, which is also inevitable, or even worse, by the way, people you love dying while you're still there, like your parents, your children, like your close friends. So I think we have every single day, and especially in the Western world, we don't really acknowledge that. I think some Eastern traditions have already better ways to sort of preempt that problem. But like in the Western world, we push that fear away. So people don't talk about that. But if I talk to parents normally and I ask them, they're like, yes, every single day I'm afraid something bad could happen to my child, an accident, whatever. So in that nagging fear of your own death somewhere, and even worse, of the death of your loved ones, is like a constant nagging trauma. And religion, faith, is soothing that, is softening that, because all religions tell you there is something bigger to that life. There is something bigger than to your carbon-based life. And somewhere after that, you will see the people again who you loved. And that is a soothing effect, which I think we completely underestimate how important it is in your life. So then the purpose stuff is we long to be part of something. Meaning we're pack animals. That's very genetic, I think. So, and what is happening in our life, unfortunately, purpose is taken away from us because of technological revolution. So, and I think people are, I believe they're smarter than we would maybe sometimes attribute to them. Maybe the taxi driver doesn't know what AI exactly is, but I think people feel somehow, for example, that in 10 years, this person will not drive the car. He knows or she knows that. And that creates a loss of purpose, which we see throughout the world at the moment. And then the third one is love. We need, again, we're pack animals. We need close relationships. We need family. We need friends. We need to feel loved. We need to actively love. And again, unfortunately, if I look at all three of these things in the Western world, especially, but also I think, as you say, in India, these components of our mental health immune system are on the decline. So faith is evaporated because science for a long time told us, oh, we cannot be faithful or believe in something at the same time and be rational human beings that is sort of at war with each other, which I think is bullshit. Again, purpose is evaporating because of technological revolution. And then we also started to kind of dissolve traditional family models, nations. So all the things which bind ourselves together, we sort of started actively or whatever, accidentally destroying. And this is why I look at the world. Practically, I think for all of us, sort of our immune system is weakened. And at the same time, again, we're still experiencing, because it's part of the human condition, bad things. And this is one of my explanations I have why mental health issues are so much on the rise. Because something needs to have has changed. Because you would say, hey, 20, 30, 40 years ago, by the way, factually, the world was crazier. But people were not. Now mental health is the number one problem of our time. So there must be a reason. And that's one of the explanations I have.
That's insane. I mean, my mind is literally bursting right now with what you said, because I think I read that India has one of the largest undiagnosed mental health cases in the world. And this is an assumption, I'm not sure. What often soothes those cases is very strong family structures where You know, even if you have depressive episodes, you know, I'm not, you know, saying that people don't have depression. They can be managed a lot better because you've got a tight family system who may not be therapists.
No, but can they're the better therapists, actually, yes. I think. Yeah.
They can act as pseudo therapists or help you reintegrate into life again, right? And then I do notice that when people move away from family systems and go into smaller and smaller structures, they find themselves at a loss of meaning, and they find that they cannot rely on friends or relatives. That's when they start, like, you know, withering on the inside, and then the slow decline happens, and then you see that those people fall sick more, and all of those things happen. Wow, man, that was such a... So where do you think you are on this hypothesis? Have you covered all fronts?
What do you mean covered all fronts? Like
faith, purpose, love?
Well, I think these are the... From my point of view, these are the three main components. Yeah, and then, yeah, that's sort of, for me, that's a set model. Like, there might be some other, there are definitely some other factors, but I think these are the main ones who give us sort of the strengths to go through adversities.
Okay, let me talk to you about the fact that when I looked you up, it said billionaire a bunch of times, right? And that must be a heavy word, because now everyone knows how much money you have, right? So you're basically wearing a label on yourself at all times, right? And you are also an investor. You're someone who founds companies. You have, you know, you like psychedelics. You do a bunch of different things. There's all these labels, right? So every single time someone compliments you for your genius or for your business acumen, right, what it does is it elevates your ego. Now, I do remember reading or listening to one of your appearances where you said that you actively try to master the ego, right? So how do you figure that out? Because, like, even me, I'm, you know, I want to know, like, hey, I can remove all of what we talked about and just pigeonhole you as a billionaire dude.
But then I would resist. Like, I think it's like, okay, it's, again, it was a lot of questions in one. I think, first of all, like, I was always... And I don't know why, I would always credit my parents. So I had an amazing, very basic upbringing. Like, I grew up in a 200 people mm-hmm. village, like, really, like, very, like, yeah, in a good way, basic, like, very organic, natural, wholesome, yeah. Like, whatever, earthy, exactly what you want to call it. Like, not coming from any successful or rich background at all. My parents were working class and still alive, but they just retired. But, like, sort of... And I think this was super healthy, yeah. And one thing I was always very aware of, but I can't tell you why, is that you never a single label, yeah. So you so much more as a human being. You have so many facets. In my case, sort of, I always knew I'm gay, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was always fine with it, yeah, for myself, yeah. So, but then I observed my situation, and by the way, this is like 45 years back, or like 35 then when I was like 10 and 12 and da da da, when you think about that stuff. But it was very early. Like, it was like, okay, I'm living in an area of Germany back then, very conservative. It's not going to fly. Like, me coming out is not an option. Or it is an option, but then I'm going to be the outcast. Yeah. But I was not angry about that. Like now I'm, people are like, oh, like, if people don't accept me as I am. And I was like, but that's just a fraction of you. Yeah. That doesn't mean if they don't accept you gay that immediately... is a full rejection. Like, they are still my friends, so they like something about me. Uh-huh. So I just decided very consciously, okay, I'm not going to come out. And it's, I meaning some people might say now, oh, this was cowardish, but I was like, why? I just also realized that being gay is one thing, yeah. I am, out of 20 other very important things, how I would define for myself who is Christian. Yeah. And I just decided that these 5% of my sort of personality is for that period of my time, because I always knew I'm going to move away, things are going to change. Yeah. It's just not the one I want to emphasize right now. Mm. Yeah. So, and I emphasized other things which are also me. Like, so for example, I was very good. I loved learning, which is a little bit like, it was a little bit nerdy. Yeah. So I learned, I was focusing more on school. I was focusing more on friendships. So I had great friendships in my teens, like, again, but I also spent a lot of time on learning. So I had great grades. What happened is, and by the way, that's what I truly believe. This is why I'm such a big fan of Deepak Chopra. Yeah, but I believed it before I discovered him. Like, it was always kind of, and you know, when you think, when you never even think about things, when you just, like, know mm-hmm. how you think life is, yeah, I always believe that things which might feel hard in the moment, if you sort of tackle them the right way, they're gonna be the basis for your biggest success. Yeah.
So like amor fati, like loving fate, even in its hardest moments?
I don't know that expression. Yes. But like, give
it's
an,
like
give,
a stoic okay, like, love give, for fate.
Give me an example. So in my case, very practical, sort of because I didn't want to come out, because this would have been bad, yeah, I decided to focus more, as I said, on school and other things. So that gave me extremely good grades. So that good, the extremely good grades gave me an extremely prestigious scholarship. And that scholarship allowed me to meet the two guys with whom I then, two professors who were my tutors.
And you started RiboFarm with them.
Exactly, with whom I started my first company. Yeah. So I always jokingly say, if I had been straight, I would have dated the shit out of my teens. Like, I would have had different fun in life. And I would be totally, not bad, by the way, it's neutral. But I wouldn't sit here, I'm very sure, because I would have been the player, yeah, and would have definitely not spent as much time on school, wouldn't have the scholarship, wouldn't have started Repo Pharma, wouldn't sit here. So
you can reframe your past in a way that makes sense for you.
So now is obviously the question, that's sort of, this could be a little bit not critical, cynical, whatever, but do I frame the past that it makes sense to me? Maybe, yeah, but I have more of these things, and I just think, by the way, about faith and about view on life, there is always these sort of, it's like, I think it's just a better way to live your life, to sort of truly believe that. Even if it were not true, I do believe it's true, also spiritually true, but like, even you're happier like that. You're like, just more like, don't fight certain things because there is no reason. Yeah. And that is, again, we're having this young generation who on the one side thinks it shouldn't have any adversities experience, like safe space, blah, blah, blah. And on the other side, they're picking one thing. Yeah. Being gay, being transgender, whatever, and make their whole life about it. And they're gonna be so miserable. It's like, it's a recipe for a mental health disaster. Yeah. So, and I also think it's so degrading to yourself if you really make yourself attached to exactly one thing. It's sort of like you're an amazing, beautiful flower, and you attach yourself to one tiny thing of your character. Like, humans are so much more than just one thing. Whatever that one thing is, you're so much more than that. And you just should be able to explore that and sort of play on sort of like an instrument, play different themes and different times of your life. Yeah. You know what I want to say? Like, it's
of
like,
course, of course. Yeah. 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 Which also is a testament to the number of things that you've done, the multiple companies that you've started. Specifically, now considering that you have such a robust life philosophy around like faith, love, psychedelics, all of that, and yet you run all of these multiple businesses, I'm just, you know, based on what I've seen, how do you go from like basically going from nothing to constantly building wealth? Because I've seen that building wealth is often a matter of temperance, timing. So what is it for you that allows you to just, you know, scale? Is it something that is innate to you? Is it something that you've learned along the way? Is it something that you've had an aptitude for since you were a kid?
I would almost say if you focus on just people from the outside would say it's building wealth. Yeah.
Hmm.
And I tell you, like, I can tell you always when I focused on that aspect, oh, I want more money or more wealth, I made my biggest mistakes. Yeah. So because... And I made my biggest successes when I didn't focus on building wealth, but I focused on building great companies, doing something which I'm passionate about, doing something which I think other people will like because it's a product they want to buy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like, but I have to admit, like, I had moments, yeah, where I was like, oh yeah, like it's like whatever, you want to be measured by that and blah, blah, blah. But that normally is also a bad recipe. So I try to sort of remind myself, I have more money. Again, I'm coming from a very, very normal, humble background. I have more money than I ever thought. Yeah. And by the way, already at a fraction of what I have, your life doesn't really change. I know it sounds so cliche and he's saying that, blah, blah, blah. But like, but it's the truth. If you don't have crazy wishes, like you need like
what
whatever.
What if you do?
Well, then you should reconsider your wishes. Like, yeah, but like, I think what makes us truly happy, you can have, it sounds so cliche, but like, you can live a great life. Like, again, you want a certain amount of money now. And this is like, I'm not the one who says, oh, it's all about like, whatever,
balance.
Yeah, right? Because like you need a certain money is a great thing. Like it's opening doors. Like, but it's also there is a base thing. What you have, you want to have a great apartment. You want to have be able to travel, like things. But like that is it's not infinite growing with more money. So So I think the important thing is as an entrepreneur to say, look, what, and I at least can say that for me, like what I really, really like is building companies. Yeah. I like having new ideas, but transforming or creating, actually, it's creation in a true meaning, like, yeah, creating things, like things can be companies, but it produce movies as well, which is similar creation process. So bringing ideas to life, and hopefully if it's biotech, that's why I really, really love biotech. You always help people with it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So helping people, but also just creating something nice. We have an amazing hotel brand, and hopefully we give people some hours of happiness in our hotels. Yeah. We have great consumer brands, whatever, but building something which makes other people happy in one way or the other. It makes people happy because we heal them from a problem, makes people happy because they're just spending a nice time. So that what makes me happy, actually. Mm-hmm. And then I realized if I do that, then I have actually real success.
Yeah. How were you able to scale effectively to several companies? Was it you sacrificing certain things that other people enjoy? Was it acquiring a kind of personnel who could lead these companies? Or is it the fact that you are not just the guy who starts it, but also the guy who operates? You know, like there's...
So it's, again, it's knowing yourself. So I would say... I realized I'm not the best operator. Okay. Yeah, because I want to have more things than one company, so I have more ideas. So I always say I have some character traits which are really good for an entrepreneur, having the idea, the vision, but also being able to bring people into that vision, and develop it. But then I normally team up with people who are great in running companies, mm-hmm. and who love it, by the way. There are other people who say, oh my God, what you are doing, I could never do. I want to have one company. I want to have the same sort of environment, the same every day, like sort of, and then finding these complementary people and sort of building these companies with them. So that was one big realization. Yeah. Then I do think I work a lot, but not in a bad way, like because I love it. But again, I remind myself every day if I'm waking up and I bore like weekend, like normally I work weekends, like, yeah. And then when I'm like, oh, this is a lot, then I'm like, okay, I could change it. And I tell myself, then just start a company less. And then I'm like, no, I really like it. Like sort of, so reminding, so I think I work hard. So I could say, but it's not the right word if I say I sacrifice things, because that sounds sad and negative. Yeah. I just actively decide. Again, it's all about what do I want in life? What do I have fun with? What makes me happy? And what do I don't? There is things other people will be very happy and I'm not, like, so I just like just structure your life again. It's all coming back to these basic things again, but then teaming up with people. I'm very believe in teams who complement you, but then that also means you need to be able to share, so you can't
you can't hold up all the wealth. You can't be like, you can't get all the credit, which comes back to this idea of mastering the ego, right? Like how do you say, okay, you know, I've started the idea. Have you become better at running these things as time has progressed? Maybe with the psychedelics, you've become like more cohesive with running these, or is it because you've learned it the hard way?
Both. Definitely both. I mean, you make mistakes again, and then you also accept that these mistakes happen. Like, it's not nice, like, and you're sad about it, but I think I have, it's all about these. I mean, I'm always coming back that I remind myself, whatever happens, hopefully happens for a positive reason, even if I don't see it in the moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that helps you going through adversity. So, and then mastering the ego, I would say I try, like nobody masters the ego. Like, I think we all kind of, it's a constant, but battle is also so negative. Yeah. You always need to see it as a fun thing. Like, I always think like, sort of, what I don't like is like, oh, battle your ego, whatever. Because like, again, I think life is way more playful than most people make it. Because I also believe, like, my big, maybe that is a sentence we can talk about more, because like, but I truly believe we have an eternal soul. Yeah. And we're just doing this over and over again.
I think you're a closet Hindu.
Well, yes. No, by the way, I'm very, the only thing is, I don't know if you know better, like, but it's more like Buddhism, when people want to escape their soul. I don't even think you want to escape. My view is always like, imagine for 1 second, you truly, fact you could have an eternal soul. And then think about mathematically, which, by the way, is mind-blowing if you really, and I realized it fully on a psychedelic trip, what eternity really means. Because eternity is so, it's a little bit like God. It's like, it's a thing we can't really comprehend, what eternity really means.
You can only understand it in analogies.
Yeah, so, but in a simple way, that means I can be every human being and every story ever lived. Because, like, I just do it again, and I can even be like, and I saw it that one of the trip that I had tried this life already billions of times. Because you can, there is no limit to anything. You can say, I want to live the Christian character over and over again, and the only thing I change, but okay, because it's like, it's so not in a, I want to say it's not meaningless, it's the opposite, but it's like we don't have a word for it. Because, like, and for example, I would say I live the same life, but I just don't do that podcast. That's the only thing I want to change. So I look at my life like a game programmer, yeah. And I think, by the way, very close to computer gaming, that idea, yeah, or that whole idea, are we in a simulation? I don't think it matters. Like, I think we are in a simulation we put on ourselves, like our soul put on for us, yeah. And, like, again, you can live your own life, the, in my case, the Christian life, over and over again, and just change one thing. And I change next time. I'm not doing the podcast. And
then so let's sorry see. To hear that.
Exactly. Oh no, no. But, like, you know what I mean. And then see, but, and I bet this life gonna be better with the podcast. Yeah. But I can observe it, my soul as a neutral observer after these two lives. Say, okay, what's the life better? It's just like, and by the way, there is, in a good way, there is no reason except of experience. It's just, if you have eternity, it's just the joy of trying things out. And if you realize that, or if you think about that, then many things become a little bit less painful, because, like, it's just like an experience. Yeah, I know it's hard to say, because I always say, like, you're saying that normally in a moment when you're, like, in a good phase, and then you then have harsh things in your life, and then I need to remind myself. So I want to avoid that people who are watching are saying, yeah, but he's saying that because whatever, he's white, successful, da da da. Yeah. So trust me, had hard times. Yeah. And again, like, so I always come back to this gay story, like, where other people would break over it. Yeah. And anyway, so but I do think, like, we should take life in a more playful way, because I think that's what it truly is. It's a play, a game we put on, our soul puts on, just to learn, experience interactions, experience emotions, experience love, experience hate, and all of that. And that makes many things more easy to take.
And yet there is so many young entrepreneurs that you often see them tweeting about just the eternal strife of running a business, the hardships, the pain, and all of that. And I think especially, like, in the young entrepreneur business community, there's a love for pain. There's a love for, like, the pains of life, as if it's forging you in the fires to make you something great. But the sadness is that the pain never goes away. It just, you know, it's year one, and then year five, you're still inflicting more and more pain, and you don't seem to get anywhere. Like, I've met few people who run successful businesses who are also playful and relaxed. It seems like they're running on overtime and basically, you know, working themselves to death.
I would say it's like, it's the wording. It's like, is it pain? If it's really pain what these people are feeling, then they should immediately stop it and not do it. Because, by the way, I think
it's a lot of complaining, I would say, yeah, about the hardship of doing it, I guess.
But then you shouldn't do it. Like, I think also, like, by the way, one other philosophical or spiritual concept I hold is, like, emotions tell you if you're on the right way or on the wrong way. And if your emotions are constantly telling you, you feel pain, you feel negativity, whatever, I think you're just on the wrong path in your life. Yeah. The other thing is to sort of, where's the line? Like, if people say, hey, I have a business idea, and I know if I want to really realize that, I need to devote my whole time. So I need to, again, sacrifice is such a negative word, but I need to make decisions. Yeah. Then I say, like, that's the right thing. Because some ideas, if you want to be a great entrepreneur, especially, by the way, now, I think with technological innovation, entrepreneurship gets harder and harder. I just wrote a blog post. I didn't publish it. I sent it to my portfolio companies, where I was like, look, that's the moment to really think about if you really want to be an entrepreneur. Why? Because I believe AI, yeah, and sort of the velocity of innovation AI will bring in all sectors, because AI is like a platform technology. It will change biotech. It will change software as a services business, everything. Yeah. It will be even harder. So I was literally telling all my portfolio companies, now is the time to check out. If you don't think you can work even harder, even more committed, whatever. Let's rather try to sell your company in the next 2-3 years because it's going to be just harder. Yeah. But it's not negative. That's just asking you, look, is this what you do worth your full focus, your full energy? And again, I don't have another word, sacrificing other things or exchanging, let's say it neutrally, exchanging other things for it. Yeah. If you can say that is worth it and you're happy, let's do it. Yeah. If you feel pain all the time, oh my God, like, please don't be an entrepreneur. It doesn't make sense. And I think,
But it's also a very glorified profession now, if you think about it. Like, everyone who's young wants to either be on YouTube or wants to be an entrepreneur. So, like, which is why there's a lot of delusion with which people jump into it, and then they don't understand that it's in their DNA, but it's cool to sort of having failed and build in public, which is why they keep going on.
I think maybe it was just one thing, like, one other thing is, like, it's like that level of definition. Like, what I said with happiness is for me this underlying condition of truly knowing you're on the right path in life. And even if you have that, you're gonna have hard days. And I have days where I, like, I don't want to use the word pain, but, like, where I'm like, oh, this is, like, really hard. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but I know on a deeper level, I'm on the right path. So the question is, if I would tell an entrepreneur, like, do you know you're, like, on the right way and it's all worth it? Yeah. Then do it. Even if you have one day where you have pain, if you want to use that word, but you don't do it for that, or don't glorify that. That's like a side effect, or that's like a necessity or something. You know what I mean? Like, But I do agree. Like, I think founders do glorify that too much because somehow they think that's it. And that's actually almost like a bad signal for a founder for me.
Yeah. As far as, I had a specific word I wanted to ask you about. Everywhere on your website, it says family office. I tried looking it up. It made no sense to me. I mean, I was struggling with the definition. What is a family office?
Well, family office means we're managing mostly my own capital.
Okay.
It's sort of this term for,
Thought you had, like, the Rothschild family behind
you.
No.
It's like the family office. No, but, like, in my case, I'm the first one in the family. Like, it's like, okay, it's not an intergenerational, it's like, exactly. Yeah. Hopefully I have children. Yeah. But, like, it's like that I manage primarily my own capital. And then we started to manage outside capital, like 4 years ago, and now we're sort of half-half. We're sort of a hybrid between a classical, what you would call a family office, or somebody who manages his own capital, and sort of outside capital under management.
Amazing. So since we're at the minute mark, and I know I have to let you go, first of all, thank you. I think your work with psychedelics is revolutionary, but that is just scratching the tip of the iceberg. There's several things that you do. I think your way of thinking and the way you come up with thoughts, it's like bursting at the seams. It's like, it seems like you were having a prophetic revelation when you were speaking.
Well, that's like,
I know what it means. Some people are very certain speakers. They'll speak in complete sentences and then stop. But it's one thing to speak and then have several ideas jumping in and then trying to stop them at once to make a certain sentence. So I think you speak like that, which I appreciate. Of course, where can people follow your various works, your various, like, things you do, maybe social profiles?
Well, on Twitter, it's C, like for Christian, _, and then my last name, Angermayer, AngerMayer, LinkedIn. Twitter and LinkedIn are the two ones that which I'm doing the most, yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much.
And Instagram,
man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I had fun speaking with you.
Thank you. It was amazing. Thank you.
Amazing.